I'm Oliver Goodenough. I'm, as you heard, both at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and at the Vermont Law School. And I'm going to explore with you creating and consuming scholarship in the age of information overload. And I want to start with a little bit of a prelude that will date me, rather, I'm afraid. But I want to go back to 1971. It's the fall of 1971 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when I was an entering freshman at Harvard. And there were a couple hundred of us gathered together as part of the orientation program into a big lecture hall, and we were given an assignment. So we're going to give you a test. We're going to test you here. Here's the material you need to read. At the end of 10 minutes, we're going to give you a test. Now, the problem was, at least from the standpoint of a student, was that there was far too much in that packet that they had given us to possibly read in 10 minutes. And the entire point was, when we got to the end, you could answer it if you skimmed, and you could not answer it if you read. And their entire point was to say, at college, you will experience an information overload. This is 1971. You will experience an information overload. You have been taught to behave as a literal reader in your high schools. You've been taught that you should read everything, and that's what your job is. And now that you're coming to a realm of college and of wider scholarship, no, your job is, in fact, to skim, to figure out what you need to read in depth, and to become a much more omnivorous and yet discriminating consumer of information. So in the fall of 1971, essentially, we were being told to behave like what we're now being told is our problem. So we fast forward 40 years, and probably the skimming isn't a problem so much anymore. The internet, games, video on demand, other digital distractions abound, as we've heard. We're in a world of which is training us, in fact, not to be that complete, thorough reader, but rather to be the creature that my orientation was trying to turn me into. So that's the question. Have they taught us too much about skimming and selecting? Have we gone too far the other direction, and is that a threat? And what does this do? What is this world doing to our very brains? We'll explore that for a few minutes. What is it doing to the enterprise of scholarship? And what is this world doing to your livelihoods? I'm here speaking to a group of people who make a living out of transacting in scholarship, most of you. And so that's perhaps a very interesting question. As we explore this, some intertwined themes here. First of all, what we do shapes how we think. That is something that neuroscience is telling us more and more. I want to explore briefly the role of reading in scholarship, because reading is a piece of all of this. The impact of the digital age on all of these things. Thinking about disaggregating scholarship. What does scholarship do? And what happens to that which we do in a world of Googles and Wikis? How we train for that, how we publish into that, and then a little bit on what we've gained and lost before a final coda. So, experience shapes our brains. What we do does indeed train our brains. As neuroscience is revealing, we have a great deal of neuroplasticity. There are two or three times when that's wide open. Early learning reopens again in adolescence a bit. But it never fully shuts, and indeed stays open throughout our lifetime. If you remember anything that any of us have said today, it is because your brains are still plastic. You are still able to form new memories, and the forming of new memories is, in fact, retraining your synapses a little bit and reprogramming them a little bit so that they will have a new content that's involved in them. So if what we do shapes how we think and how we understand the world, culture and education work with this. They work with this, making us smarter at certain kinds of tasks than we otherwise would be. Boyd and Richardson, a pair of scholars on culture who are very, very worth having a look at if you're interested in the theory, have pointed out a theory which they talk about culture as a cognitive workaround, that in effect we're plugging in new ways where we're training people into kinds of mental gymnastics that we wouldn't necessarily be good at in that kind of state of nature, tabula rasa kind of notion. So that we are constantly absorbing ways to think a little better than we would otherwise do. In my field of law, I've written a little bit on this and suggested that law is exactly this kind of cognitive workaround, that law is a set of procedures and attitudes that shape us into a better approach to problem solving, a better approach to disputes with our neighbors than simply turning each other loose with AK-47s would be. You know, if left to our own devices without law, we can settle disputes, but we're probably less good at it, and in the end, rather more collateral damage than going through even the worst of the kind of slow law process. Think about next time your lawyers start to give you advice and you go, we're probably adding value in that context. We can view reading in that same kind of way. Reading is not, by the time we're at the age of most people in this room, reading is second nature. We do it naturally, we do it unconsciously, all of those things. But reading is hard to take on board. And the experiences of reading and the way we experience prose and text is another way of shaping our thinking. It is creating channels for us. It's creating avenues. It's creating bridges across streams. You know, it's all of those kinds of metaphors. Reading is not a neutral exercise. It really does help shape our cognition, and the way we read, the way we experience it, is one of the things that will help or hinder us as we become scholars. Language is the precursor of all this. Language is a human universal that allows many things. I'm going to point to three. Sharing information. Okay, language helps us to share thoughts and information. Storing information. We can store it in language, in memory, and in ways that are useful in text outside. And it's also a workspace for articulated thought. There's a neurological theory out there that consciousness is, in effect, a kind of workspace, a little bit like Google Docs or something like that. We can put things up in that space and then work on it in ways, use language, use tools other than just our intuitive immediate thinking to shape and work on it. And as a scholar, that's one of the things I do and relish the time for, is to take that time with words and with a piece of paper or a screen to work and shape. So it's a workspace for articulated thought. And writing and books accelerate and extend this. Sharing and storing, we can understand easily, of course, they let us do that better. The more writing, when we get books and print and all that kind of thing, we can share, we can store, all of that is great. But also, I think that it's worth remembering that the workspace expands and the capacity for articulated thought expands with it. There is something about writing your way to a set of understandings that at least works for me. I start with some muddled ideas. By the time I've got a book, if other people are interested in it, that's great. I now know the topic in a way that I didn't previously. And that's as much of a value for me as anything. So, are deep writing and reading also deep thinking? This is one of the themes in that book, The Shallows, I ripped it straight from there, from Nicholas Carr's book. That's one of his arguments, is that there's a depth to this that we work with that we are perhaps losing in an age of information overload and distraction and places where we go for short fixes rather than the depth. So, what does the internet do? Well, internet, again, if we look at that same set of things, increases access. If access is one of the things we want, access has exploded. Sharing worldwide and instantaneous. The things that you used to have to go to the major libraries for are available on mobile devices in Kenya. It's just fabulous, what you can do from that standpoint. And I'm a great believer in that the access has increased wildly. It increases storage. Whether it's your own journals and things, but also libraries in the cloud, the Google Book Project, Project Gutenberg, all of these things are out there. I can find books and read them, and they're stored, and storage is massively increased. So, as we heard a little bit, the supply side exploding, doing all those things. It also puts many traditional economic models at risk, as I've said, and that may be the hook for many of you attending after all. Because there was an economic model that was built around using books for these purposes, using journals for these purposes, the printed word, which is not going to be the same economic model. As many of you know, you're facing that in your daily lives. What is that next economic model? How do I build into that? Where do I go? So it is going to change that. But it also, I think, multiplies but shrinks the workspace. In other words, we go from a spot where our own head is a piece of where that workspace is. Now we can share it with others. We can go to Google Docs. We can interchange. We can do all that kind of thing. It's multiplying, but are they each of them becoming shallower as we do? It's your point about the long periods of time that are necessary to get deeply into something, to think that way. And as we spread out, are we thinning them as we go? And it also fragments our attention. It's not just a matter of time, it's also a matter of attention. I don't know about how you feel, but at my age, I'm short on time, but what I'm really short on is attentional gear shifting, the ability to come up out of one set of thinking and into another set of thinking and then come back again. But that's what really takes the time. So if deep reading is deep thinking, what is the web doing to us? Is it challenging us in these ways? Well, before we answer that, I want to point out there are prior transitions in scholarship. Where we are now is a point of change, but there are many of them in history. That this is not the first time that we've changed some modalities in all of this. In fact, it's probably not the last either. At a very gross level, there was kind of the pre-printing world of scholarship, verbal presentations. In fact, what we're recreating today is a kind of a throwback to the medieval a university, right, where people stood up and came together and talked. We had dialogue and debate. We'll get some of that going maybe in a little bit. And memorization of large works. People memorized things. When I went to school, you still had to memorize a few poems anyway. And that kind of memory work is something that people who had lots of it now decry. You know, how can you possibly be a scholar if you don't know by heart X? Well, you know, there we are. I don't know by heart X. Maybe I'm not a scholar. Printing moves a bunch of this. It moves the book and the paper become the thing. We start sending journal articles to each other. All of that kind of thing starts to replace some of those verbal presentations and dialogue and debate. Did we gain or lose? I think probably on the whole gain, although we lost some things. Was deep memory deep thinking? Would somebody in the 1500s say, I know all these books, you know, you're not memorizing anymore? So I ask us next to change gears a little and say, what do scholars produce and share? Because I think it's useful to kind of break this out again, this classical notion of disaggregation. Boyer, in a white paper on this, has three things: the discovery of new knowledge, the development of new technologies, methods, materials, or uses, and the integration of knowledge leading to new understanding. I, as I prepared for this today, came up with my own list. This was a little longer. There's research, both primary and secondary. There's data and description, the development of data and the description of things. Ideas and analysis, order and synthesis, kind of pulling all these together, which relates a bit to then theories and explanations around these things. It's not enough to simply lay those out, although that in the law, legal scholarship, sometimes that's all we do. It's also useful to have arguments and proofs, things that will convince people. And then validation, this ties into our prior speaker again, peer review and other method, this key element of scholarship, which is about validation, and that's, I think you've heard all about. And then references for others, that deep literature search, the references for others. Again, in legal scholarship, which is famous for endless footnotes, right, where we have half a page of text and half a page of footnote, and that's moving fast. Why is that the case? That's the case because, again, in our world, the reference for other function was very, very, very important and high. We were a discipline based on very careful citation, and so what we had was runaway citation in the day when citation was expensive and hard and we needed to find. Nowadays, citation is cheap, as we'll see. Maybe that goes away. So, how does this happen in the age of Google and Wikipedia? Boyer's list, discovery and development, again, are aided. They're just aided by this. When I researched this paper, where did I go? I went to the web, right? That's where I went. Where did we all go? So again, all that is aided by that. But perhaps it's the integration piece is not necessarily aided. Are we taking too much and just this putting it all together without that integration piece? Again, I'm not so sure. On my list, as I said, references get trivial. I think that the reference function goes away, or if it goes away, if it doesn't go away fully, it becomes something you do once in your life, and then you've got your bibliography that essentially is a cumulative thing, and you post on your website, and then, you know, there it is. Do we improve research? Again, as I say in this presentation, I read Carr on Kindle. I read the Shallows on Kindle. I thought there was an appropriateness to that. And went to Boyer on Google. But what about thoroughness? What about thoroughness? And again, that's where I think we've got some challenge here, because I'm not sure that the web is a great educator about thoroughness. We tend to use it instead of thoroughness. I don't know that. So that piece of what scholarship is about, I think that's an ongoing piece, is one that we're going to have to figure out how to make work both in how we train scholars and in how we present scholarship. What about depth? And then, as we heard earlier, what about validation?
Well, educating future scholars, I think that they need experience and practice in thoroughness and depth. They need to experience and practice those things. The dissertation, the description we heard, was partly about that. Why all of that endless literature review and all that? It's because it's important that as we put people in through the portal of these things, that they have experience of what it means to really know a field. I talk about a lot of fields I don't fully know. I'm doing it today, right? But I have once or twice in my life done that, read everything in the field, and I know what that means, and I know where to go and how that works when you have to. So you have to roll around in existing ideas and data. That's a piece of, I think, we need to make sure that we maintain and train scholars. Validation of data and method. Again, wikis, I'm not sure, are a substitute for review. Again, we heard that, and this notion that the validation piece may still be where a lot of value added comes in. And then finally, this, I think it is important that we maintain the fact that writing your way to good ideas and conclusions is an important piece, that there is a depth piece in that, and we need to hold scholars to doing that as they go forward. And that may be the greatest challenge in these. They keep holding people to that idea. Role of publishers. Aggregation used to be a big plus, right? What one thing you did was you aggregated. That was fabulous. We could go to a single journal and read. Now Google makes that unnecessary. So if disaggregation is the new challenge. There are techniques of layered knowledge, right, of depth and going down. Data, methods, and references can be stored separately. Again, those resources of reference and depth can be asked. Taken out of the articles. We see this happening, right? Major journals now with the method sections and the data available three steps down through the click. Summary of conclusions, data, and logic with deeper and deeper argumentation behind it. Help by creating deeper workspaces in the new media. This is actually like a challenge which I would urge you to think about. I certainly don't have a solution, but if one of the things is if the personal workspace is getting fragmented and shrinking, the communal workspace may be growing. And one of the ways that we may actually accelerate certain kinds of knowledge is by allowing things like Google Docs or other shared workspaces to actually occur, and we may get a kind of smarter through that while we get loose on the other. Validation, again, that may well be the continuing value add that the journals do, and that certainly the prior speaker suggested. So anyway, I'm looking to colleagues, I'm looking to you in the audience, hopefully we'll have a chance to chat as we go forward on more ideas about the role of publishers. Implications beyond scholarship. Because we're talking about scholarship, and indeed, I'm less worried in a sense about scholarship, because I think that the people are trained in these things in the new media as well as they used to be in the old, is the society at large the real concern? Are we seeing a narrowing of viewpoints in a world of greater diversity? In other words, the Fox News CNBC effect, where people gravitate towards the things they already agree with, and therefore hear less and less of anything they might disagree with. That, I think, is actually a big problem for us. There's less challenging of our beliefs as we find islands to live in. Differential processing of image. This is an interesting thing. Image processing around normative questions tends to lead to greater energy of decision-making, greater certainty. There's different ways when you process them visually than if you process the words that scholarship is revealing. And certainly a shortening attention spans and the conversion of a consumer and a citizen into something to be managed rather than something to be given real choice or education is a problem. But by the end of the personal coda here, first of all, PowerPoint and presentation, shame on me. You know, this is one of the great attention lapse media that exists. Here I am trying to explain things to you and putting print in front of you. Well, there we are. Panels like this one. This one I'm hoping that we can have a good discussion around here, because as we go back again to that medieval format of disputation and debate, that's a possibility that we have today. I want to finish with my own children. One reads, they're 21 and 17, and the 21-year-old reads voraciously. Loves Dorothy Dunn. I don't know if any in the room here read Dorothy Dunn, but that is not, that is thick stuff. The other one, the 17-year-old, is in high school taking both Latin and Greek. Now, I can't say that's probably typical, taking Latin and Greek. And both surf the web several hours a day. So that I think what we're seeing is, in some of the publication, is an alarmism, an excessive alarmism, because I think that people the kids today are still able to bring serious attention to things when they want to. They know what that's about. They just know that it's different from what they used to. And indeed, Colbert and Stewart, I was watching with my son yesterday, are making them more sophisticated in lots of ways. We're asking about critical thinking. Where are they learning critical thinking? They're learning critical thinking about visual argumentation from John Stewart. Okay? He's a great lecturer on how to think critically about what the press is giving you. So there are outlets for this. So I think, and then the final line, it's a little Pollyannish, is a new synthesis is emerging, and it's probably okay.